All right. I appreciate everybody here. I'm calling the meeting to the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Thursday, March 9th, and the time is exactly 11 straight up. We're joined by Representative Carrick, Representative Wright, myself, Chair Rauscher, and in the audience, we don't have any legislators to speak of, so I would like to thank our House Record Secretary, Jordan Wright, and our LIO moderator, Zachary Lawhorn, for all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone in the audience and those here at the table, silence your cell phones and any other personal electronics. We are going to have a presentation, so if the members of the committee would hold their questions until the end of each slide and direct your questions through the chair, and likewise those presenting, if they would also reply to the legislators through the chair when you're speaking, I appreciate it. Today we're going to hear a presentation from Sarah Hall and Chris Hall from Recharge Alaska regarding electric vehicles and related infrastructure in Alaska. They will be with us over Teams. We can pause after each slide for any questions. And with that, Ms. Hall, if you can hear me, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation?
Thank you. This is, for the record, Sarah Hall with Recharge Alaska. Thank you for hosting us today for this presentation. Let's go ahead and jump right in. On the first slide, just introducing myself. Second slide, just kind of going over the agenda for the day for my presentation. I don't know if anyone in the audience or in the room has driven electric, but just going over the basics of electric today, and then going over what Recharge Alaska has done to make that accessible for people. And then, you know, possible regulations to consider or other considerations within the state. So moving on to the third slide, plugging in. So driving electric is a little bit of a mental shift from driving a gas vehicle or an internal combustion engine. It's a lot like your cell phone. You would plug in at night and it's charged up when you wake up, and you don't really have to go someplace separate to charge your phone. It's very much the same when you're driving an electric car. So most charging happens at home. About 90% of charging your vehicles happens at home. And the shift that we need to start considering in the future is that that's accessible for people who have a place to charge at home. As vehicle prices come down, and as the secondhand market starts to pick up, new models come out, people want the new model, they sell their old one. More and more people who are living in apartments sort of situations are going to need to be able to charge, and if they don't have a place to charge at home, we are going to see people who are going to have to go someplace similar to the way that they do for gas to charge up their EV. So that's something to consider. The daily use of your vehicle, like town driving, you don't really have to fill up every day. Usually for us, my husband and I both drive an electric vehicle. In the summertime, we fill up every 5 or so days. The winter, it's every 3 or 4 days. It's not every single day. And people that would need to consider filling up every day are people who drive for a living, Lyft drivers, taxi drivers, those sorts of things. And the only time that you really fill your battery all the way up to 100% is when you're going on a longer road trip so that you can get to the next charger. Hopefully that becomes less of an issue as we get more chargers on the road system. So there's 3 different plug types, as you can see in the diagram on this slide. There's the CCS, which stands for a combined charging system. It's combined with the J1772, which is that level 2 plug type that you see on the left. And then the CCS is the same plug, but with DC pins on the bottom of it that allows for fast charging. So the J1772 is used for the slower charging that you would do like at home. And then CCS is for fast charging. The Tesla plug is pretty common, but it's proprietary. And then the third type is the CHAdeMO, which is only used for the Nissan Leaf, as far as I'm aware, in North America. It's been phased out entirely for every other vehicle type. It has some limitations. It can only push about 50 kilowatts through the plug type. So if you want to fill it faster than 50 kilowatts per hour, then you're going to need something more powerful than that CHAdeMO type. So those are the basic plug types there. Next slide charging up.
I just want to make a statement here that Representative Fox joined us early on around 11:01. And I was just, I had a really quick question on that other slide myself before I asked the, you have four different, seems to be different types of hookups. In a charging station, are all four of those located? And are all four of those required to be located for a charging system? Or can there be any combination that your community or your town or state desires to put up, if you understand?
So of the four types, the J1772 is the slow charger type. So that would not be located on any fast chargers. Okay. That would just be for level two, things that you have in your garage kind of a thing. The other three types, so on our machines, we have a CHAdeMO connection and we have a CCS connection. Because Tesla is proprietary, we don't have access to it, but we do provide an adapter so that it can go from the CHAdeMO side to the Tesla side. There's also a CCS to Tesla, which allows for much faster draw for those vehicles so that they're not limited to that 50 kilowatt that can that the CHAdeMO limits to. So for example, when the Alaska Energy Authority distributed the funds for the VW settlement, they required both CCS and CHAdeMO to be on all of the fast stations that were installed. And I know that for the upcoming NEVI funding, the only requirement is CCS. They're not requiring CHAdeMO anymore, I think because of that plug type is being phased out, and because of the size of the machines that are being required for that NEVI funding. So the only thing that is required is CCS. I would love to see Tesla on more of these fast chargers, but they're proprietary and it's really hard to get hold of them. So at this moment, our next best thing is having that adapter available. And we've looked into, for our company, we've looked into attaching, having two CCS cords, one on each side of the machine, and having a Tesla adapter attached permanently to one side so that way one side is CCS and one side is Tesla. But at this moment, that's the only requirement that we've had is the CCS type to access that funding.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Before I go to a question from Representative Wright, I would like to make note that Representative Shragi has joined us around 11:07. Representative Wright, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Rosher. Through the chair, I'm just curious, does it cost anything to use these? Are they free charging stations? If so, if it does cost, how much is it? And how much can you get? Like, what's the rate?
It does cost to use a fast charger. Each installer or owner can choose what they set the rate at. There's actually some trickiness to that because different regions don't allow us to sell by the kilowatt. We're required to sell by the minute in some regions, which creates some disparities that I actually had planned to talk about later on in my presentation. But for fast chargers, these are very large machines that are doing a lot of draw on the grid. And at our stations, the ones that we are able to charge by the kilowatt, we charge 60 cents a kilowatt. Currently, I know that there are other stations, depending on the region that they're in, that might have different prices. I'm fairly certain that the supercharger, the Tesla supercharger that's in Birchwood and the one that is in Soldotna both charge, I think, 47 cents a kilowatt. Each person who owns and operates their machines can set their price. for those. There are a lot of level two charging stations, that's the trickle charge, essentially, that are free, that are available to the public, depending on where you go. I hope that answers most of your question.
Representative Wright, follow-up?
Yeah, it sounds like, through the chair, it sounds like it's faster. The faster you charge it, the more it costs. Is it just cheaper to charge it at home?
It is, absolutely, yes. The charging at home is going to be drawing from the power grid at the same rate as the standard, residential. So I think that's part of the reason that most people charge at home, but also because, that's where you spend a lot of your time when you're not driving, is you plug in at home when you're asleep and it charges while you sleep and you don't have to worry about it. So definitely charging at home is significantly less expensive.
Representative? Good.
Thank you.
I have one more question. You basically said you fill up, I believe was the term you used, every 5 days, 4 or 5 days. Can I ask you, without asking for your actual address, where do you live?
I live in South Anchorage.
Okay, so you're in the city. And so yes. I was just trying to figure out, myself living 65 miles out of Anchorage, how that might translate into fill-ups as far as, say I was to commute to Anchorage back and forth every day. So I was wondering if you had any idea on the projection on what I might experience.
I do, actually. Some of that actually is in the next slide. We're ready to move on. But a lot of that, the answer to a lot of these questions is it depends. It depends on the vehicle that you purchase. It depends on your driving habits. It depends on so many other factors. It depends. So if I can move on to the next slides, that would help me answer this question a little bit more. So on that next slide, charging up the machine specs, talking about the size of each machine or level type, and you can see in the table that it lists, typical output of power at those different levels. And then at the very end, that last column is the time to charge. Level one is measured in days because it is a triple charge. It's just your standard 110 outlet plug that you would use. Level two would be about the size, the same draw as like an electric dryer in your garage would be. And in fact, a lot of people will use the same outlet that they use for their dryer in their garage. And they'll unplug their dryer and plug in their mobile connector for their vehicle and just use the exact same outlet. So that's a possibility. And that's measured in hours, depending on how large the battery is and how drained the battery is. I typically plug in my vehicle when I get to about 20%, and I charge it up to about 90%, and that takes my car about 5 hours to charge. So it's done even before I have gotten up for the morning. If you have a larger vehicle, like I know that there are some vehicles that have, up to 212 kilowatts for the Hummer EV. It's a very, very large battery. But that also means that you can go a little bit further typically before you have to fill up. So it, kind of depends if that kind of helps to answer that question for you.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody, questions for the committee? Please continue.
Okay. So just related to charging up, that I already spoke about the level one charging. Level two charging happens in residential, typically at home. The other places that it can happen, that make sense, if you are an EV driver, are places where you're going to be for extended periods of time. So places like at your place of business where you work. If you're going to be there for 8 hours, you might as well charge up your vehicle. This is like the airport, and other places where you're going to be parked for a long time, like hotels and such. So those are all really good places to have level two rather than level three. The level two is a less draw on the grid, and it stays below that demand fee for a lot of people. So it's a little bit easier for that, but it does take significantly longer. Level 3 chargers are getting more and more powerful these days. So back in 2017, the first 250 kilowatt charger came onto the market. And then before we'd even gotten to the end of 2019, we had a 350 kilowatt charger. And there's talk of a megawatt charging system that's going to have a max capacity of 3,250 kilowatts of power. So those are getting really big. And those are intended for things like semi-trucks that are going to have very large batteries. And, you know, speaking from experience, seeing a semi plug in at our station, it took 2 hours and they got about 91 kilowatts of power, and that didn't even fill them up all the way to 100%. So the, you know, our charging stations are about 50 kilowatts for each machine, and that is just not going to be sufficient if we need to have those larger and larger vehicles. We need to be able to push out much larger amounts of power to them much quicker. So it kind of gives you an idea about charging and the different levels of charging. If anyone has any questions before we move on.
Yes, Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Appreciate the presentation, Ms. Hall. Sorry, I was just a little bit late. When you describe the machine, what are we talking about inside? How does that machine operate? It says machine specs. What is the machine that's doing the charging?
So for the level one, each vehicle typically comes with a mobile connector, and on the mobile connector, it's similar to the brick that you receive with your laptop so that you can plug into the wall. It has that same sort of thing for an electric vehicle, and it has different attachments on most of them where you can choose to have it, the cord end be the 110 sort of plug, or you can detach that and attach a larger plug that would be like
for a dryer.
The size that you would use for like a dryer. And then it still uses that same like brick size that to do that. The level three, because level two is converting AC to DC, which is why it's limited to that like no more than 19 kilowatts. Because it's converting the power from AC to DC. Batteries store energy in DC power. And with level three, the machines are able to give the car the power in DC directly. And so the machines are much bigger, and you can see in that slide, it said that it's about the size of a freezer or larger. And, you know, that depends on the manufacturer of the machine. The machines that we are using, and there's a few pictures in later slides that show about the size of those machines.
So the machine is basically a power converter. The machine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I got it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And Representative McKay joined us way early on. I apologize that I didn't make note of it. Thank you for your question. Anybody else have a question? All righty. Ms. Hall, please continue.
All right. Slide five, let's drive. So this kind of goes over just the basics of how far you can get. The ranges of different vehicles. 80 miles is something that you would find in one of the older Nissan Leafs. The newer ones are getting much longer ranges. And there's a lot of Nissan Leafs down there in Juneau, because you've got about 80 miles of road and about 80 miles of range. So they're the perfect vehicle for Juneau. And newer cars are being built with like bigger and bigger batteries. Like I mentioned before, the Hummer EV has a 212 kilowatt battery. And the voltage ranges are going from 350 to 920 volts. So we're talking a lot more power here. There's also semis from various different companies, not just Tesla, that are being developed that will have even larger batteries. And the bigger the battery, the better it is for Alaska, because then if you have a larger battery, you're able to get more range, even with our range loss that we'll experience during the winter because of road conditions and because of temperature. Current batteries they like to be kept at about a similar temperature as humans. So you don't want them to get too cold or else they won't function. That's when they start to draw on their own power to heat. They also don't want to be too hot. So in hotter temperatures, hotter climates, some of the energy from the battery itself is used to cool the battery. So you do lose range when you have to either heat or cool the battery. And as we get bigger and bigger batteries, we'll get more and more range, even with that loss of range from those factors. Even if you are losing range from temperature and, you know, rolling resistance from snow and slush and things like that, EVs are still more efficient than internal combustion engines. Most of the power from an internal combustion engine is lost in heat at the tailpipe. So it's really, you know, kind of wise for us to use that power as much as we can. So EVs are a little bit more efficient in that regard. And as you can see, the Department of Energy lists that 32.3 kilowatt hours is about the same equivalent of 1 gallon of gas. And to give you a little bit of an idea, you know, about the battery sizes, the vehicle that I drive has an 82 kilowatt battery, and the vehicle that my husband drives every day is a 64 kilowatt battery. So the vehicle that he's driving every day is about the equivalent of 2 gallons of gas, and he only has to fill up every couple of days. So it's a far more efficient system in that regard.
So, Michelle, can I ask you something? You have a photo here of what appears to be a tractor for an 18-wheeler operation. If that tractor was to, say, have a 40-foot trailer on the back and it was loaded with whatever it was delivering and it looks like it's going to be traveling, let's just say a 20-degree day, how far will this tractor trailer be able to pull whatever items it's loaded with? Just in a guess, I know you don't have the exact number. You don't have. Are we looking at hundreds of miles? Or are we looking at 60 miles?
Because of the size of the battery, we're looking at hundreds of miles. This one in particular, I don't know any of the specs. I think that this is a test vehicle that was plugged into our. This is actually a picture of it plugged in at Golden Valley's machine in Fairbanks, but they also drove down to Delta and plugged into our machine in Delta as well. So I don't know for sure what the specs are for this particular vehicle, the Freightliner. I do know that Tesla has published their ranges, and they're saying that, you know, obviously California weather is a little bit different. They're saying that they can get 500 miles of range with a loaded trailer. I think that that's being a little optimistic, and I think that in Alaska we're going to see, we can assume based off of data and studies that have been done here in Alaska through ASAP, that you're going to lose about 40% of your range in the winter. So, you know, if this has a 500-mile range, you're losing about 40%, maybe losing a little bit more because of a fully loaded tractor, then probably looking about 200 to 250 miles of range before it needs to fill up.
Right. It's like about a 40,000 pounds of a load there in mountains in winter. And
yeah.
So there's probably a lot of mitigating. But anyway, I appreciate the so far. And any more questions for Representative Prox has a question?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, how long will it take that battery is drained down to 10%? How long does it take to recharge it to get its 250 or 500 miles, whatever?
For the semi specifically, you're asking?
Yes.
So that's a really tough question because if they were charging at a 50 kilowatt machine, which is what my company has installed in the past, it would take quite a number of hours. You know, like I said before, we saw one that had plugged into our machine in Delta and they were plugged in for 2 hours and they did not get fully charged. They probably would have needed to be charged and plugged in for, I would guess, 7-8 hours to start getting to that range. And that's why, you know, I previously mentioned that the machines that are actually being built are getting larger and larger, and that megawatt charging system is starting to be developed so that that way, if there are semis on the road and they want to plug in, that megawatt charging system will charge them up significantly faster. Because if it can push 3,000 kilowatts of power and the battery is 1 megawatt, it would take less than an hour for it to fill up, if that makes sense. So the easiest way to think about this is if you have a car battery that is 100 kilowatts, just for easy numbers, 100 kilowatts, and you have a 50 kilowatt machine, you can guess that it would take about 2 hours to fill up. If you have a larger machine that's, you know, say 250 kilowatts or 350 kilowatts, it becomes less than an hour. And that's why on that previous slide, it said, you know, anywhere from 18 to 120 minutes for a standard vehicle. Now, the semis are going to be something entirely different, and we haven't yet explored putting in something that large. So at this moment, we are still kind of shifted towards the general public rather than commercial interests for our business.
Representative Wright, Representative
Foster, follow up. To that, as these charging machines get more powerful,
yes,
will the infrastructure support those machines? For instance, at the Golden Valley, there's a power pole right to the right of the machine, and if you drop the cord directly from the power line, would a 50-watt or a megawatt machine overload the transmission line?
I think that really depends on the kind of far behind the meter infrastructure, what their substations look like, what their, you know, all of those things look like. And we've actually worked really closely with Golden Valley. We've received grants from them to install two of our locations. So really wonderful to work with, and they've been really open and communicative about what their sites and their lines can handle. And I don't think that we would ever be ambitious in putting in a machine that would overload without, you know, going over what can your system handle. Let's work together on this. Let's figure out what's going to be right for this community, for this current infrastructure, or how we might need to change that in the future. So definitely there, it's important for installers to work with the power companies so that they make sure that they're not overloading those things. I suspect that it's going to take a very, very long time to get semis up in Alaska, just because, you know, we're pretty remote. We have, you know, because of the distances, power draw changes quite a bit to send that power to the remote locations that they would be needed in. So I don't know how long it will be before Alaska sees semis, if ever, but that's definitely something that they're like looking into pretty heavily in the lower 48.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Representative Brox.
Right. So you were saying you're working with Golden Valley. Have they given you any sort of an estimate of, shall we say, electric vehicle penetration into the market before their infrastructure needs to be upgraded?
Not to my knowledge, and Chris might be able to answer this question a little bit easier than I can, but to my knowledge, no. Especially when you consider that the amount of draw, if 90% of your charging happens at home, you know, developers for neighborhoods, land development, they work with the local utilities as well to make sure that they're not overloading the utility. And it would be the same for us. We work with the local utility to make sure that we're not overloading any of their lines. But they haven't given me a number that's definitive on, hey, when we get to this saturation, we're going to need to upgrade. You know, there are a lot of people who are pretty, like, dispersed. So if most of your draw is happening at night, similar to the way that you would charge your phone, and at the same rate that you would use for an electric dryer, I don't know that that would really need to be considered in the short term. But I feel like Chris would be better to answer this question, because we did speak with an engineer actually with MEA about potential overloading and how we would mitigate that. So I don't know if you want him to jump in and answer that now, or if you want to.
Mr. Hall, would you like to comment now, or you want to wait till later?
If I could comment now, I wouldn't mind answering that question for you. So Golden Valley has published information in their monthly booklet that they send out to everybody. I think it was at the early 2022, stating that if every vehicle that is currently registered within the Fairbanks district was to switch over to EVs, they have enough power on demand in order to support EV charging on all EVs that are currently registered in Fairbanks. That was before they shut down their coal plant in Healy, so I don't know where they stand right now. But beforehand, they stated that they had enough power on demand, enough reserves, in order to support the EV transition within their utility. And as Sarah was saying, MEA talked a little bit differently, not necessarily about power reserves, but more about the distribution network. We, as installers of equipment, follow NEC, whereas utilities follow NESC. And so there's different codes that they get a chance to rely on, which uses averages. And so if you take a look at the average home use from the past 20 years versus the next 20 years, the average home use is going to go up drastically with EVs in place. So they have work to do. And I haven't talked to Golden Valley about what that looks like specifically on their part. But I believe every utility will have some work to do in order to prepare their grid for more use case, because the average is going to go up. Whereas NEC, we have to plan for the worst case. So it's just a difference on the codes.
Follow up. So I've heard from Golden Valley in another hearing that the intertie between Healy and Fairbanks is already at its capacity. So with the current electrical vehicles that are there. So it would seem to me that it wouldn't take that many more electric vehicles drawing 20 kW to overload that line. But you haven't heard from them about that particular situation, I guess. Is that correct?
Correct. I have not. I do know that as demand grows, line extensions and upgrades do happen. I look at Fort Knox that was put in place in the mid-90s. And they got a direct feeder line out of Golden Valley. That project alone was only a few years, and we're talking EV adoption is going to be over a decade. So I believe, and I trust, I guess, in the utilities that they're going to limit their brownouts, blackouts, by upgrading infrastructure to support the additional loads. They have a financial benefit to doing so. So I envision, and this is me putting assumptions in place, I envision that they will be able to meet the demand.
I'm going to go on the Representative Wright here for a bit. Representative Wright, and then Representative Shragi.
I'll hold my question until the next slide. It looks like they're going to cover it.
Okay. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, just while we're on the topic of some of the constraints on the system for electric vehicle charging, can you speak at all to some of the at-home charging systems or even the available to the public charging systems and built-in technologies to address off-peak charging to be able to balance some of that demand? Is that a pretty common technology at this point? What is the level of integration? And are there things that we should be doing to ensure that as we see more electric vehicles come into the market and be utilized in greater numbers in Alaska, we can ensure that we're able to most effectively use the energy that we're generating?
Yes, good question. So Juno is the only utility that I know of currently that is doing off-peak EV charging infrastructure. None of the other utilities have opted for an off-peak. They did have an opportunity to review their loading distribution systems during an RCA open docket that was in 21. And each one of the utilities along the rail belt came back and said that off-peak wasn't an issue for them at this time. Be mindful that the amount of EVs in Alaska right now are less than 2,000 for full battery electric vehicles. So the amount is a very small penetration into the market. So there's a small hit right now. This is our learning phase. This is our trying to understand what's going to be happening for grid usage and non-grid usage. Most chargers, so like both vehicles that Sarah and I drive, we have an opportunity to put in a time of use charging within the vehicle itself and say, we want to start charging at 9 p.m. And be done at a certain time. And we can put that into the vehicle, and the vehicle will hold that time until it's ready to charge and then charge up at that point. So there is some flexibilities already built into EVs. There are some level 2 chargers that are out that are smart, if you will, that only limit when charging can happen. They can also lower the amount of power going to a vehicle during peak sessions, if you will, and then increase based on non-peak usage. So there's a lot of flexibilities that are already built into quite a few pieces of equipment. But as for in Alaska, the only place that I know of that's doing off-peak charging is Juneau.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hall, please continue.
All right, so common questions, which would be that slide 6. Do they work in Alaska is probably one of the biggest questions that I get. And yes, the answer is yes. There's quite a few EVs all over the state, all the way up to Park. There are numerous companies on Slope that have ordered electric pickup trucks, which you can see that this is an electric F-150 in the picture here. It was plugged in at our machine. But you do lose range, which I already spoke to, up to 40% as per ASEP. They did a study back in, I want to say, 2020 or 2021 over that winter. I think they did it for the entire year and tracked the data for an entire year to see what it was summer compared to winter. So you do lose range, and you just kind of plan for that, just the same way that your phone battery doesn't really like being outside in the cold. And you know, if you're trying to take pictures of northern lights with your phone and it gets really cold, it's going to kind of struggle with that. So those are things to consider. Other common questions that I see are, how long does it take you to charge up, which you have already asked. And the answer is, it depends. What are you plugged into? So you can charge up as quickly as 18 minutes, depending on the vehicle that you have and the machine that you're plugged into, or as slowly as, you know, numerous days if you have a very large battery and you're plugged into a regular 110 outlet. So planning ahead, making it accessible for yourself so that way you don't really have to think about it anymore. You know, you plan ahead once. We have one charger in our garage that works for both vehicles. We've never run into an issue where we were both needing to plug in immediately in order to go somewhere. It's pretty flexible when it comes to charging up at home in that regard. We have run into a few times where we've been on the road driving to go see family in Fairbanks, and we'll show up and somebody's already plugged into one of the fast chargers. And in those cases, you know, you just wait until the charger opens up. But as more machines are installed, there will be less of that requirement to wait, if that makes sense.
Ms. Hall, we have a question. Yes. From Representative Kerr.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Hall, I was trying to figure out where this question fits in. I guess it's kind of a basic one. So existing power outlets and power outlet infrastructure across Alaska seems like something that Alaska has kind of uniquely situated. Can I use some kind of an adapter to plug into existing, like, you know, I plug my car in to heat the battery blanket in the winter? Is there any kind of an adapter or anything like that so we can use some of the existing infrastructure out there? Or does it have to be at specific charging stations? And yeah, I guess that's the first question.
Okay. The answer is we already utilize the existing infrastructure. The only time that you would need something bigger like what we install is if you want to charge up quickly. So there are quite a few people who don't even install a level 2 home charger in their home. They just use the mobile connector that came with their vehicle when they purchased it, and they just plug it directly into the wall. So that is available. It just does take a little bit longer because it's a slower amount of power delivery.
And a follow-up?
follow up. Go ahead, Ms.
So through the chair, the other question I have too is, you mentioned your phone doesn't like it when it's cold out and you're trying to take pictures in the cold or something like that. And that's really exacerbated in a place like Fairbanks where we get negative 20, 30, 40 below on a fairly regular basis through the winter. So is there any challenge with the battery? You know, somebody might assume they have range to drive from, say, Tok to Fairbanks or vice versa, and then if it's a really cold day, lose battery power much more quickly than they expected. So is there a potential in sort of our Arctic climate to have additional charging stations or something like that as a backup plan? Because I could definitely see where someone hits the road and then loses their battery power much more quickly than they expected to.
Yes, actually. Most of the funds that are being made available through various grants are looking at trying to get stations about every 50 miles. So I know that specifically for the infrastructure bill, the NEVI funding, they want to try and get every 50 miles on all the major road systems to have a charger so that way people aren't left without a place to charge. That presents a little bit of a challenge for Alaska because there are areas where we don't have power. There is no power at all between, you know, just south of Delta and on the Richardson Highway, just north of about 11 miles north of Glen Allen. Between those two points, there is no power at all. You know, everything in Paxson is run off of generators. So in order to put something into that spot, we would have to either run it off of a generator or find other creative solutions to install new power stations there. You know, similarly, there's a dead spot on the Parks Highway as well, south of Cantwell and north of Trapper Creek. There's a big gap there. I think it's at 78 miles or something that doesn't have any power. And there is that transmission line that's there, but it doesn't step down the power at a usable amount for us to put in a charging station there. So there are possibilities for plugging in. I know of someone who drove up from the lower 48 in their electric vehicle in fall, and they definitely lost range quicker than they had hoped to, and they ended up stopping and charging at a regular 110 outlet in Beaver Creek for 3 days so that they could make it in. And then when they made it into Tok, they were able to find somebody that would let them plug in to an outlet that was used for, I think, a welder. So it was a little bit faster than a 110 outlet, but any way that there's power you can plug in, it just depends on how long it's going to take.
Follow-up, Representative Kerr.
Just one more follow-up. Thanks for the indulgence. Through the chair, the other question I have is if my phone's near dying and I want to plug it in, but I still want to be able to use it, I can, and my phone just won't charge as quickly if I'm actively using it to browse the internet or make a phone call. And in many parts of Alaska, you would want your car to still be running while it's charging. You might have charging stations in places that, you know, if it is 30 below, you don't necessarily have a place to be warm during that time. So, is it practical, I guess, to charge a vehicle while it's running? And, what's sort of the test case in northern environments on that kind of usage?
Yeah, so you can, the amount of power that's used to warm the cabin and do just basic functions inside the vehicle is very minuscule compared to the amount of power that's required to push the vehicle forward. So you're still going to gain power quickly. The limitation would be on if the battery is very cold, it can't take on the power as quickly as maybe the machine might be able to deliver it. So that kind of depends on if the battery is conditioned to receive that power. We've plugged in our Chevy Bolt at, I think it was minus 36 degrees in Glen Allen, and hopped inside of the vehicle, obviously, to stay warm. And it received power, it was using quite a bit of power to warm up the battery so that it could receive power faster, and it was also using power to keep the cabin warm, but it was still able to charge at the same time as doing that.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Wright, you have a question?
Thank you, Chair. So are there any issues with, like, if you're in the interior and it's extremely cold, like, just starting the vehicle, is there any issues with that?
No. The battery management system will keep the batteries at a temperature that can be always used. So you might have, like, phantom drain if you leave your vehicle parked outside. We have a friend that actually our very first installation that we put in Cantwell, we put it on his property, and he owns an electric vehicle. He does not have a garage. He leaves it parked outside all year long, and he hasn't had any issues there living in Cantwell. He drives it up to Healy to go to the grocery store at Three Bears there, and he hasn't had any issues with it starting up at all.
Thank you.
All right. Any more questions? Please continue, Ms. Hall.
Okay. So that final question was, what's the maintenance like? The maintenance is minimal. You don't have to do oil changes. You don't have to worry about spark plugs. You don't have to worry about a lot of those things. The battery's technology is getting better and better so that they last longer and longer. And the battery management systems are getting really, really efficient as well. So on my electric vehicle that I owned and drove for 4 years before I decided to trade in, the only maintenance that I needed to do was a new windshield when it got cracked and changing out tires for the season. So, you know, the cost to operate the machine itself, the car itself is less than operating an internal combustion engine, an ICE vehicle. So that, I think, is going to be a big draw for a lot of people that don't necessarily know how to work on a vehicle or don't want to work on a vehicle. It's a nice draw to not have to worry about oil changes and those sorts of things. Next slide is just talking about Recharge Alaska. We started out working with a decommissioned machine from Nissan, a Nissan DCQC machine, and just tinkering with it in the garage. We wanted to put it in so that we could make it to Fairbanks and visit family without having to stop to charge for 5 hours in the middle of that. We wanted to be able to stop and charge for only 1 hour if possible. And the challenge with that machine, and those are the machines that are actually located there in Juneau. There's some, those Nissan DCQCs are down there. They are decommissioned. They're not made anymore. They're not supported anymore. And you can't get parts for them anymore. So that has become a challenge. And it, as those machines break in general, they probably need to be replaced with something that's new, that's supported, so that those residents can still continue to charge up their vehicles if they choose not to do so at home. So once we realized that we needed to have a machine that was still supported, we went out and purchased our first machine from Trading Technologies. And it's this one that you see in the picture. This is our installation in Cantwell. And we were able to do this pilot project with the help of GBEA. They gave us a grant for this site. They wanted to know what driving in Alaska looks like. They wanted to understand what the driving habits were of Alaskans and those sorts of things. So we worked with them to install this site. And once we realized that it is possible, you move on to the next slide, we started to expand, and we wanted to provide an opportunity to travel not just in the summertime, because that travel route with just the one site in Cantwell was only available it was available all year round, but your car might not make it all the way to Cantwell from Anchorage or from Fairbanks in the wintertime. So we wanted to start opening up more routes. That's when we installed our Healy installation in December of 2021. And then just this past year, we've been working on opening up the Richardson Highway. So we've installed in Delta Junction, which has actually gotten quite a bit of use from vehicle manufacturers doing winter testing in that area, in that Fort Greeley area. And then we also installed a machine in Glen Allen. And we actually drove our electric vehicle up the Richardson side through Glen Allen and Delta Junction for Christmas to go up to Fairbanks this past year. One of the challenges that we have faced as a company, though, has been working with the existing rules that are in place. things like we weren't allowed to, when we originally installed our machines, we weren't allowed to charge by the kilowatt. We had to charge by the minute. And that means that people who plug in the winter, who take longer to charge up because the battery is cold, end up paying more in the winter than they do in the summer for the same amount of power. And there are, you know, other disparities. The other challenge as well is that if you're only allowed to charge by the minute rather than by the kilowatt, why would anyone install anything faster? You know, it kind of leaves people in this situation where it disincentivizes larger machines if you can't charge by the kilowatt.
Ms. Hall, yeah. We're down to 10 minutes. I'm going to have everybody hold their questions till the end. Hopefully get through the next 3 or 4 slides. So just let you know, we have about 10 more minutes left of this committee.
Great. Nearly finished, actually. So just talking about some of the issues that we've faced just with the Alaska climate and what we have. We've had blowing snow. We've had a lightning strike near our machine that took out our machine. We've had coolant freeze issues. We've had no cell service, which is actually a really big issue for payment. You know, if you show up to a machine and it requires you to have an app downloaded on your phone and you don't have it and there's no cell signal, there's no way for you to download that app. So we have a credit card reader at each of our machines rather than requiring people to download an app onto their phone. One of the biggest hurdles that we've faced as a company trying to put in these initial sites was finding site hosts that were willing to put in a machine or that were even thinking about this, the EV space in general. So we have found some really wonderful site hosts, and we've been really lucky to work with Golden Valley on 2 of our sites to install them and had really great site hosts that wanted to work with us at those 2 locations that have made it a lot easier. We would love to install machines in all of the major travel nodes because, you know, if 90% of your charging happens at home, the only time that you need to plug into a fast machine is when you're traveling to a further distance. So travel nodes are where you're going to want those bigger machines located. And we have actually, if we move on to the next slide, you can see that there's definitely expansion happening. And this map shows all of the fast chargers that are located in Alaska, not just the Recharge Alaska stations, but all of them, including the Tesla superchargers and some of the sites that have been installed using the VW settlement money that was distributed through the Alaska Energy Authority. There's lots of other grant opportunities, and we've actually been contacted by some people in North Pole, Valdez, Anchorage, Palmer, all of these areas, some of which are actually looking at installing using various grant opportunities, not just NEVI. So that's, you know, it's definitely starting to catch on. Communities are definitely recognizing the value of having those things available for the public. And then the final slide, just jump right to that, is the considerations. I already spoke a little bit about the resale of power and how it really does create a disparity when you have to charge by the minute rather than by the kilowatt. You know, you buy gas by the gallon, not by how fast it's distributed or how, you know, it's the amount that you take on is how much, excuse me, how you are charged for that commodity. And I know that there was a ruling through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that changed it so that you could, if you are an EV machine installer, like a charging installer like us, that you could have a special rate where you are able to charge by the kilowatt. And that is helpful. However, that was an opt-in thing. So I know that the power utility in Tok, and I know that Copper Valley has chosen not to opt into that. So for our machine that is in Glenelg and that's on Copper Valley's grid, we have to charge by the minute, which means that in the wintertime, it's a lot more expensive to drive through there. That charging curve that you can see on the slide is both of our vehicles. We drive a Tesla Model Y and a Chevy Bolt. They were plugged into the exact same machine, and they got the exact same amount of power, that 41 kilowatts. But it took 53 minutes for the Tesla to receive it and 85 minutes for the Bolt to receive it. So not just the summer to winter changes on disparity of charging by the minute versus the kilowatt, but also the vehicle. So some vehicles, like the Nissan Leaf, are limited in the amount of power that they can receive, whereas other vehicles can receive it significantly faster because of the battery management system on board on the vehicle. So charging by the kilowatt makes a lot more sense. It would be really nice if that was something that was, you know, regulated and required to allow us as installers to be able to charge by the kilowatt rather than by the minute. Other considerations are things like the plug standard. There's not really much that we can do because there's the largest network in the lower 48 is Tesla. And even though it's proprietary, you know, it would be really nice if we all moved on to that CCS type. The EU has mandated that all vehicles have to have a CCS type 2, whereas CCS type 1 is the standard in for most manufacturers in North America other than Tesla. So I know that, you know, Alaska can't decide, well, every car has to have CCS because then Tesla just probably wouldn't even sell to Alaskans. But it would be nice if we could figure out a way to have adapters required or access to those, you know, that Tesla cord so that we could have a native Tesla cord on our machine rather than having to have an adapter at all. I don't know that there's anything that you guys can do as a legislature to change the plug types, but it's just a consideration to think about related to charging of power based on power rather than on time is things like we would love to relieve the load to the grid by adding solar to our sites. Solar currently doesn't really have net metering as an option. So we still have to be connected to the grid, even if we do have solar, but without net metering available, that disincentivizes us to add solar, which would relieve some of that weight onto the grid. So a consideration for maybe adding net metering and maybe making it annually rather than monthly. I don't know what the benefits are for that for the power companies, but that's a consideration to think about. What else did we have? Payment types. Oh, I already touched on this a little bit. If you're in remote Alaska where there is no cell signal and you have to have an app to charge your car, you don't really have a whole lot of options. So it would be really wonderful if it was required that every machine that takes payment takes it in the form of a credit card reader rather than letting people just have an app. If you have to have an app, you have to have a smartphone and you have to have cell signal for the cell phone to communicate with the machine in order to initiate the charge. So it would be really wonderful if we could kind of get past that idea of having to download an app. I think there's about 8 different apps out there for the different companies, and it seems a little excessive to me. Another consideration that isn't related to charging of EVs, but is related to EVs in general, is direct sale of vehicles versus through dealers. There are some states that have moved toward this idea of having, you're not allowed to have direct sale. I don't know that that's the right way to go just because that forces Alaskans to have a gatekeeper. You know, those dealers are a gatekeeper. And the dealers are going to get all of the service that needs to be done on these vehicles because they're really smart vehicles, and they're going to need people who know how to isolate the power in order to work on the vehicle rather than just, you know, some average person tearing it apart in their garage. So I think that being able to have direct sale as an opportunity is still really important. And then other things to consider are road tax. EVs don't currently pay road tax because that is paid through gasoline sales. I don't know what the answer is to that, but it's something to consider. Some states have added on a surcharge of about $50 per year when you register your electric vehicle in order to account for that road tax. And then,
Ms. Hall, I have to ask a question. How long can we be here over past 12? Does anyone know? There's no meetings, so we can hang out for a few minutes. because Representative McKay has a question, and I'm sure there might be one others. Those that have to leave, I understand. But go ahead, Representative McKay.
No, just really quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Hall, I just have to ask. I want to understand, you said direct sale. Does that mean you have to buy an electric vehicle from a dealer? And if you want to sell me your used electric vehicle, we can't do that? Is that what you meant? I want to be sure I understood.
No, that refers to the model of, so like if you want to buy a Ford F-150 Lightning, you have to buy that through a dealer. You can't buy it directly from Ford. But if you want to buy a Tesla, I could buy it on my phone. I just go onto the app, put in the order. There are no Tesla dealers. There are only service centers, and when you purchase one, you purchase it directly from them. There are other companies that are considering this. In fact, Ford is one of those. They are considering branching off their electric vehicle division into its own company with direct sales rather than going through dealers. But as far as resale is concerned, I don't think that there are any restrictions for resale.
Okay. Just want to make sure I understood that. I'm not sure I can buy a Ford F-150 directly either, can I?
Currently, no. You still have to go through a dealer.
Right. Are there any other questions? Representative Fox?
Yeah, I'm a little curious through the chair. I'm a little curious about your business model. Who is financing the capital cost of these charging stations?
Currently, my retirement plan. This is completely self-funded other than the two grants that we have received from Golden Valley. One of those was in the form of monetary value that we were able to put in that pilot project back in 2021. And the other was they had some extra machines that they had ordered that they had not installed that they gave to us, and we installed those in Delta.
Hmm. So you're...
Everything else has been us.
Privately funded machines, and then you get your revenue from the sales of electricity from those machines?
Yes, sir.
I applaud you for your effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Been quite a lot of work.
I have one question myself. I was just wondering, batteries. Is there, when you buy an electric car, I've never bought an electric car, is there a guarantee on a battery life? Is there a suggested battery life time that they say you might want to have your battery checked, or is there a battery life expectancy out there? And if there isn't one, I'd like to know, but if there is one, I'd also like to know.
As far as I know, the two vehicles that I own have an 8-year warranty on their battery, so that's quite a bit of time to have a warranty. I know that some vehicles after that 8 years, even if they have degraded, that doesn't mean that the battery is completely bad. It just means some cells in the battery have gone bad. And if that's the case, then you don't have to remove the battery entirely and throw it away. You can always use the battery again for stationary. Because like I said earlier, it requires way more energy to push a vehicle forward than it does to just provide general energy for regular functions. So if a battery has degraded to the point where it's deemed not usable for a vehicle anymore, it can then be transitioned into stationary power and combined with things like an off-grid cabin that has solar to charge up the battery and it powers the cabin. So there's still lots of uses for those batteries, even if they can't push a vehicle forward anymore, but they do last quite a long time. I've seen some original, you know, Tesla Model S's that came out in, let's say that was 2012, maybe 2008, I think, was when Tesla first released their first vehicle. And some of those are still going strong with no issues to those batteries. So they do go bad eventually. And a lot of that also depends on how much you have used the battery. So if you do a fast charge every day and you always go to 100%, that's going to abuse the battery a lot more. And you're going to end up causing issues with the battery chemistry itself. But if you're doing just slow charge at your home the majority of the time, and you're not, you know, driving your vehicle super hard and towing vehicles out of the ditch every day and doing things that are really challenging for the battery to push power out really quickly or receive power really quickly, the battery life is significantly longer than Like for your phone example, the phone doesn't have any kind of a battery management system, but the vehicles do. And that battery management system is designed to optimize battery life.
Interesting. So would you say fast charging your cell phone wears the battery down probably quicker also?
Yes.
I never thought about that. Anyway, I appreciate that information.
Because we're old, George. We don't know this stuff.
What do I know?
I gotta tell you, I don't have an app, and I can't even park in Anchorage because they tore out all the credit card machines. So I can't even park because I don't know how to pay.
Through the chair, happy to help anytime.
I'm too proud to ask for help.
Yeah, I mean, it touches on that like requirement to have a phone. You know, what if you don't have? What if I want to lend my car to my friend and she doesn't have an electric vehicle, but she's driving it for a few days, then she now has to download an app rather than just swiping a credit card. Yeah, that's definitely something to consider. And I don't know what the answer is for that. I've not really dipped my toe into what rioting legislation really looks like. So I'll leave that to you experts.
Does anybody have an idea of how many electric cars have been on the road in Alaska at this point in time? Is there somebody keeping track of that at all?
Yes. Actually, you can find that information through the DMV. I want to say that there are, I wrote it down. Let me find it.
Nice.
There are about 1,700. So Just under 2,000 electric vehicles that are fully electric, that does not include the plug-in hybrid vehicles. And we're seeing a growth rate of about 100 per month new electric cars coming into the state. So it's definitely starting to catch on. People really like the technology. I think people really like the fact that you don't have to do anything for maintenance, and they're really easy to drive. My vehicle is an all-wheel drive vehicle, and because the batteries are on the bottom of the vehicle rather than kind of up higher, it has a really low center of gravity and it feels really solid. I feel actually more solid driving my electric car than I do driving my truck in the snow because the truck has a little bit higher up, a little bit more body roll to it. So I feel really secure in my vehicle. I think that a lot of people are starting to recognize that is a potential advantage as well.
So are a lot of people being gun-shy of the hybrid because of the extra mechanics involved? Now you have a gas engine. You also have a generating kind of an idea there, which supplies power to your battery, which charges your battery. And then you also have you see what I'm saying? Does that make it more, are people more apt to buy those? Or are they more apt to be gun shy because of the extra mechanics involved?
I'll be honest, I don't think people think about that aspect. I think that people who want to transition just want to get the best gas mileage that they can. And if they are worried about not having any charging infrastructure in Alaska, they're more likely to buy a hybrid so that way they can, on their day-to-day around town driving, they're driving electric. But when they need to go on a longer road trip, they end up using that internal combustion engine. But if you're already used to maintaining an engine like that, you know, adding the battery system to it isn't going to be that much of an adjustment for you mentally. And as far as like, oh, I still need to do these oil changes, even though you don't use that internal combustion engine as often or as much, to go as far, you still have to do all of that maintenance. And people are pretty used to that. I think that there are a lot of people who are more gun shy about a fully electric car than they are about a hybrid. And I think that there are a lot of families who a hybrid is probably the best answer depending on their driving habits. Especially if you're worried about being stranded where there's no infrastructure. But I think that with various grant opportunities and various companies who are doing it without grants, there's going to be more infrastructure for electric vehicles. And when people feel less range anxiety and more secure in their travel, they would probably start to adopt electric vehicles at a faster rate.
Well, are there any more questions? Ms. Fala, I really appreciate the presentation. the information that we learned. I apologize. We didn't get to talk to Chris Hall that much, and he had to leave, but we do appreciate your the information you brought here to the committee today. And I do want to thank everybody that hung out to the end. Those that had to leave, I apologize that we went a little long. But having no further business, the next meeting will be Tuesday, March 14th at 10:15 a.m. And so for now, at 11, 12:10, we are adjourned.